behalf of NDMA, I'd like to thank all of you for attending this webinar and for your membership commitment to NDMA. To give you a quick update, based on the Executive Committee's recommendation, NDMA President Misty Anderson forwarded a letter this week to Governor Burgum requesting a stay-at-home executive order during the critical stages of the COVID-19 pandemic. The letter acknowledged that Governor Burgum has done great work throughout the pandemic, however, more needs to be done. A stronger commitment to isolation is in the best interest of the public and healthcare professionals. If you would like more information, please reach out to me at any time. I'm sure we're all ready to learn more from our panelists. I'd like to welcome them all. Some people were on last week, and we've got some new ones. Tonight's webinar panelists are Joan Connell, David Field, Havan Malish, Peter Van Eerden, and Anna Tobias. Dr. Connell is a pediatrician at the UND Center for Family Medicine. She currently serves as the field medical officer at the North Dakota Department of Health and leads the physician advisory group on COVID-19. Dr. Field is a board certified in family medicine and practices at Sanford Health in Bismarck. Dr. Malish specializes in critical care and pulmonology at Sanford and Bismarck. Dr. Van Eerden, Sanford Health Fargo, and Dr. Tobias, Sanford Health Bismarck, both specialize in maternal and fetal medicine. After the presentations, we will have the opportunity for open discussion. Feel free to write your questions in the question box. And if necessary, we will unmute you to present your question or discussion topic. So thank you, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Connell to give us an update.
Unmute. Sorry, are you there?
Yep, I can hear you. Yep.
Okay, sorry. I'm getting ready to share my screen.
And it looks like she may be logged off. There she is. Here. Unmute. There.
Okay. So I was getting ready to share my screen. So we could talk about the cases. So I think I'm going to try and go to that now. Actually, Courtney, can you try and go to NDDOH coronavirus and pull up the cases and then press share your screen? Because I think if I do that, I'm going to have to get out of this. And then you guys can't see the slide because it'll cut me off. So if you, and maybe I'll just get it down here on my phone. So does everybody see this graph?
I don't think we can. Okay. Let me see if I can do it, Joan.
Okay. And so, yeah. So, and if the rest of you can use your phones, if you're on your computer or vice versa, just do NDDOH coronavirus. And you'll get to this graph that's taupe in black. And the taupey orangish area is the cumulative cases. The black part is the daily number of positives. So kind of the incidence. So whereas the orange is the prevalence. So when we're talking about arguments for or against this stay at home or shelter in place order, and I'm not arguing one way or the other with this communication with you guys, but it is that black line that's really useful in figuring out when that becomes absolutely necessary. Because once that black line starts to increase, combined with when there are enough of the orange line positives, so then those are the decision, or those are the numbers that go into the decision making of when Governor Burgum would do those orders. So those of you who have heard the press conferences know that he says, be North Dakota smart, we have to do personal responsibility. Every state has to do what they think is best. And if I need to do that, I will, but I will do that at the time it is important. So I sense that those are the numbers he's looking at to make that decision. So that's one thing I just wanted to share with you since, Courtney, you brought that up, and that was a great letter. The second thing that I think is important also on this website is the CARE 19 app that I think was created by the guy who from North Dakota who made a bison tracker app. Anyway, it's basically this GPS thing that if you have downloaded that app and carry your phone around with you, it will do your contact tracing for you should you get diagnosed with coronavirus. So it's really a cool thing. Once you download the app, you're assigned some random number, so it doesn't have your personal information. You don't enter social security number, bank card, and you know, anything like that. But it does use GPS to and defines what other random numbers that are carrying the app you've been around to meet the definition of close contact, which would be within 6 feet for 15 minutes or more. So that was announced yesterday. I can't remember how many thousands of people have downloaded the app. Other states and other countries are looking at utilizing the app. So that's a really cool thing that's come out this week too, that you should consider for yourselves and recommending to your patients. And then the third thing I wanted to tell you about that I thought was interesting, and stay tuned, but Project Drive-By, which is Governor Burgum's reference to Western North Dakota's testing in Slope County and Gladstone and Amadon this weekend. Of the positives, it is important to note that half of them are asymptomatic. And per his discussion with Dr. Burks and her recommendations, that is one of the big, it was a little bit of a research project to try and identify the role asymptomatic contacts play in spreading the disease. And I think based on what he said today, it sounds like they have done some contact tracing to and are under the presumption that asymptomatics actually do play a bigger role in spread of disease than we thought, but he didn't really get into those details. But I think that that's very interesting information. And I have said all along that I think we should think everybody could have COVID, but because between the 2 days of having huge viral loads before you develop symptoms and this new, and children never exhibiting symptoms, I mean, it just makes sense that there's asymptomatic spread here. So those were the top three highlights this week.
Thank you, Joan. Any questions? All right, I think we'll go right into our next presenters then, Dr. Field and Dr. Malish.
Hello, Courtney. Thanks for inviting me. Haven and I were kind of, he was busier than I was today, so he was just trying to scurrily get into the picture. So I'm glad to see he's up and running. So. For those around, I'm a family doc in Bismarck for Sanford. I still do hospital care. I also am involved in some of the nursing home care that we do at our facility. So I want to talk a little bit and just bring up a gentleman that I had that was our first positive COVID patient. He's a 37-year-old. A gentleman that I only saw back first in November. He's an oil field worker and is based out in the Dickinson area. And he lives here in town in Bismarck, but goes out and participates in the oil field most of the other times. I'm going to do a little bit of the into things, and then my partner, Haven Malish, is going to go through and since he was present with his intubation and some of the other cares, I'm going to turn it over to Haven as he has a great fund of knowledge on kind of what went on, and then we'll kind of walk through this hospitalization and put it for you. So hopefully you can understand a little bit of some of the hassles, complications, and yet eventually this guy was discharged here last Friday. So really a success. Again, 37-year-old, history of sleep apnea. In fact, he has usually using a CPAP of 15. He had hyperlipidemia, but otherwise fairly healthy. He did have a BMI that was he's 6'3 and 360, so he's technically morbidly obese. About the 11th of March, he became generally fatigued, starting having aches, fevers. He started shivering, and 3 days later went to he was in Dickinson working, and he went to a local walk-in clinic, was told he had a viral infection, was scanned for influenza, was offered to be scanned for COVID and declined, and then went back to, after experiencing the fevers, the chills, went back to his home in Bismarck. On the 18th, he went to another walk-in clinic, but here in Bismarck, and received a swab for COVID, and then went home, but he was not told to self-isolate at that time. He was called on the 20th. So the onset of symptoms was the 11th of March. He was seen in Dickinson walk-in on the 14th, was seen in a Bismarck walk-in on the 18th, and was called on the 20th to tell him that he was positive. But he said that it was not communicated to him on what to do. Now, some of that may have been the fact he wasn't feeling very well. But he acknowledges the fact that he kind of was going to be at home, or tried to be at home, and was wearing his CPAP pretty much all the time until he presented to the ER on the 21st to the Sanford ER here in Bismarck. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Haven, who can tell us some of the other things that came about from there. Can you unmute him, Courtney?
Can Pete, everyone here?
I can hear you now.
Okay. So again, my name's Haven Malish. I practice pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine here in Bismarck. And I was first made aware of this patient, I believe, on the 22nd of March. He had called ahead of time, saying, "Hey, I'm positive, I'm coming in, I can't catch my breath." Interestingly enough, he had a prior history of obstructive sleep apnea that we knew. I think he weighed 300 something pounds, but pretty big, sturdy guy, oil field worker. And he had been trying to use his CPAP for the last 24 hours to catch his breath, and it just wasn't working. So upon arrival, he was diaphoretic, tachycardic. They found that he was in AFib, and he had never had this problem before. And they put some oxygen on at about 5 liters, and he felt better. And so it was really tricky, because it gave us potentially some false reassurance, which I knew we had to be careful about. And so a lot of the data was not, there's, you know, this is kind of learn as we go in this era with the coronavirus pandemic. But we had kind of decided anecdotally as a group, if they're on more than 4 to 5, have a very low threshold to intubate. There's some guidelines that are a little more lenient that in the interim have come out. But the other thing is that just from the first patient positive COVID standpoint, a lot of people were on edge. And so there was concern about the CPAP spraying the virus if it didn't have a good seal, or even BiPAP or the high flow nasal cannula. And so that was the other reason we had decided early intubation as a group. And so I talked to him about it when I saw him in the ER, and he said he had felt fine, though I could still, he was still a little diaphoretic, still breathing in the high 20s. We decided to intubate. And so that decision was based on those concerns, and that when these patients crash, they crash quick and hard. And we did not want a crash intubation, potentially exposing a lot of other healthcare workers in an emergency situation. The AFib was new. He was already on 5 liters. He tried his own CPAP and that it failed. So those were the main reasons. In retrospect, I'm glad we did. He was on the ventilator for about 8 days. This was a success. He was extubated and discharged home. And so we got him through it. Now, the other parts of it were, I started the azithromycin very early. The ID consultant came by later that day and recommended Plaquenil. And so I think starting these things, I mean, this is all anecdotal evidence, but again and again, we've heard cases where patients just seem to do better on these. And so, the question really becomes, at what point is it a little bit more acceptable to try CPAP or try nasal cannula? And one of my other deciding factors is I knew that if we did not intubate, there was some issues with the comfort of the staff going in and being comfortable putting the patient in on CPAP, like the respiratory therapist mainly. So I knew he wasn't going to get a CPAP if I didn't intubate too. So we made the choice and it worked out. So
what happened after that actually got extubated on day 8? Mm-hmm. When I saw him at the day after that extubation, he really had trouble getting to the bathroom. He, again, burly, strong guy, could knock down a door easily and then some. Needed total assistance of two. Eventually had a walker that he was able to kind of formulate. By the second day, he was rapidly improving. His spirits had changed dramatically. He was able to eat. The speech folks had cleared him. And he was really able to really start to get, you could see he was gaining some psychological momentum. By the next day after that, one day before discharge, he was doing very, very well. And everybody started signing off. So ID was signing off, starting to do some things. And it was up to me to ensure that he could self-quarantine. And so the ID people, he had negative tests on day 3. And day 6 after hospitalization, and he had to be in quarantine 14 days after the last negative COVID test. And so we were able to, he had a house that was at least accommodating. His girlfriend had actually been with him for the majority of time beforehand, but she was not symptomatic, but they were still isolating from each other. What we were able to find out, and Haven was very helpful about this, is that he didn't know who he got this from, but the suspicion is that he had a coworker. This was found out after he was intubated, had passed through the Denver airport a couple of 3 days before he had general fatigue symptoms, and that is the best possible likelihood on where he got this. This guy returned home. He went last Friday, so he's been home now for 5 days. I called him. He's been on isolation. He said, boy, I would love to talk to your group. He's anxious, not even anxious. He's enthusiastic about donating plasma here next week when he meets with ID. He was so, I think, isolated. He wanted to come to this meeting and really talk with us, but you will hear from him later on or in one way, shape, or form. But he had nothing but praise for Dr. Malish's group and the nurses and things that helped him. So at this point, his viral load, I think, Haven, you mentioned, was down by day three, if I'm not mistaken.
The 25th.
Yeah. His AFib has been somewhat symptomatic. He may have given a little bit of a history that he might have had the AFib beforehand, but finding it consistent, and he still remains in AFib with rate control drugs. They're still going to try to find out what they're going to do with that. And again, there were some new things that you were telling me about some newer guidelines with O2 at 15 liters that might change some treatment. You want to go through that quickly?
So the Society of Critical Care Medicine last week, they came up with some guidelines, and they have to do with respiratory care when you deal with these patients. And so the overriding factor is, when in doubt, just intubate if those show any signs of respiratory distress, of what you're currently not, what you're currently doing if it's not working. And so the take on it is that if they're requiring a high amount and you go and reassess and it doesn't make them better, it's the same as them getting worse. Now, more specifically, our group had steered away from, we'll try a reasonable, steered away from everything in between a little bit of supplemental oxygen and full mechanical ventilation. But the SCCM did put forth some guidelines saying it is reasonable to consider 15, so nasal cannula or just regular supplemental oxygen up to 15 liters, but not through the high flow unit, like the 40 liters or 60 liters. Weak recommendation for CPAP over BiPAP. And I think that has to do with more recruitment of alveoli with the CPAP, where that's useful. But if you have BiPAP, you mean airway pressure is really going to be more towards the lower number, and it's not going to help recruit. You get more recruitment with less lung injury on CPAP, and BiPAP, it does recruit, but then with the alternating pressures, there's some preliminary evidence that suggests that it might cause some lung injury. So you want to avoid that. And so the other thing that I've come across is awake proning, whereby you encourage the patient to go in different body positions, like in the prone position, where you would usually do this with the patient sedated on a ventilator, kind of as a last ditch and severe ARDS, last ditch effort. But they have started doing this with some preliminary results and positive preliminary results. The end number was only 20. So it's a small study, but it shows some promise.
The other thing we've done is we've established a team that will handle intubation. Our anesthesia folks are going to be the intubation team. The ER doc did this intubation, but we definitely want, we're kind of forming, or we've learned about how we handle this, and we're still revising that. We're still adapting it. And we hope we don't get, we see people of our brethren over in New York just absolutely just exhausted in all the things. And we're just happy that we have a support from our health system and support from good team members to really put all this together. So.
Well, thank you. I see we have a question from Dr. Anugaba. I have unmuted you if you'd like to say it.
Yeah, Courtney, this is Anu and Vijay Gaba, both here, husband, wife together. So, but we log in through the Anu one. So I have a question. Can you hear it?
Yep, we can hear you.
Yeah, I have two questions. You mentioned that the threshold for intubation for these patients should be low, but a study shows in New York City, I have lots of relatives, the patients who are coming out from the ventilator are not more than 5%, and few hospitals are showing even less than that. And even in a very good center, wherever it is going on, it is not more than 10%. One study from maybe in China or something, it's indirectly I concluded that the extubation rate is maybe close to 20%, but it is still, I think, in over here is not more than 5 or 10%. And I have a personal experience. One of my family members is in Dallas who had a COVID and 19 positive. He was in intermediate level. He was in ICU so many times. Three times he was about to get intubation, but they escaped it. But because once their saturation was 84, then they were keeping it ready for intubation. But then he came up in 92%, then they stopped. Ultimately, okay. He did very well, and he got discharged home on oxygen. I'm very nice. But that my point over here, even in New York City, they are thinking if the extubation rate is so low, why we are going to intubate these patients? So that is my one question, sir. And second thing, role of CPAP and BiPAP, because it will be open airway management, which is not very healthy for our staff or something. They want that these patients should be either intubated or not on CPAP or BiPAP or something. These two questions, I just like to open up for discussion. Thank you.
Haven, you want to take that?
Yeah, so I missed part of that. I think I got the last end of the questions. So you might have to fill in. But for the first part of it was that it sounds like there's one thing I wasn't clear on or didn't mention. There is an oxygen saturation goal that the SCCM put out. The goal is to keep the saturation between 92 and 96%. And so, you know, the robustness of the evidence behind that, I'm not sure, but it must have been significant enough for them to put in their guidelines. So if your friend or your the case you had mentioned where they were unable to keep the saturation 92 or above, that's definitely a case for intubation, because there have been poorer outcomes when you're unable to do that on the when you're trying nasal cannula or just supplemental oxygen. So that's number one, that's an indication. Number two, I'm glad that in that case they got away without intubating. But to answer the other part of that question, the reason that you don't try just the BiPAP, or I'm sorry, the CPAP or the nasal cannula, is because there's a potential when these patients crash, they crash quickly. And then you want it to be a controlled situation. So you got to weigh the risks and benefits of, okay, watching and waiting. But then if they crash hard, you're either going to have to wait. Everyone gets in a PAPR and then their code or rapid response while everyone's suiting up and potential delay of care, versus everyone rushing in, not suiting up properly, and then exposing your staff that way. So it's a risk-benefit analysis. And I think, you know, that's definitely one of the things to consider. And again, this guy, I knew if we didn't intubate, that the staff had, our respiratory therapist had concerns about giving him CPAP and it spraying and contaminating them. You know, and they... and so I knew he was going to have his CPAP that he usually gets in his usual outpatient steady state withheld if I didn't intubate. So that also factored in. So did I answer most of that, or is there a part I still didn't answer?
Yeah, the threshold for intubation, it should be low or high.
So I would still say, so your target's to get that oxygen saturation in the 92 to 96% range. And so if, you know, I think it depends on your resources. I think, you know, you have a high threshold if you're in New York City. If you have the resources, I would still have a relatively lower threshold for intubation than usual. But the thing that's changed in the last couple of weeks, since I saw this patient initially, is that it is now deemed a reasonable thing to at least consider, the way it phrases it, consider use of high flow oxygen up to 15 liters and consider use of CPAP as temporizing measures or means to try to avoid intubation. So those are reasonable things to consider depending on your resources and your hospital and your situation. But if they don't work, if you try those things and they're hovering around 88 or even 91, then the guidelines say to go ahead and intubate. Because that goal should be 92 to 96. Above 96, they worry about oxygen toxicity, exacerbating the cytokine storm that people, that is often detrimental as well in this these COVID patients. So,
thank you.
Okay,
we've got a hand raised from Dr. Terry Dwelly, and I've opened you up, Dr. Dwelly. Dr. Dwelly, you have to turn your mic off too, or on, I mean, turn your mic on.
Got it. Okay. Thanks. Just two questions. One, the dose of hydrochloroquine that was used and the duration. And then also, was there any evidence at all of any secondary bacterial infection in this person? Thanks.
Okay. I believe the, I signed out after day two because I just in checking in, I think they did start treating with broad spectrum IV antibiotics for a secondary bacterial infection. But I don't think that was the major part of the picture. And then in terms of the Plaquenil, the azithromycin is a standard Z-Pak. And I believe the Plaquenil is 400 BID once and then 200 BID for about 10 days after, roughly. And so we have had some situations where we've had to stop it because they develop QT prolongation. But in general, we have seen the anecdotal positive response with using that regimen.
This guy had a sputum that did have a gram-positive cocci that was identified, but nothing cultured out of it. That's the reason why the secondary antibiotics were started and then continued for it was probably about a 7 or 8 day course while things were going. So that would answer, I think that would be part of your answer, Terry.
Yeah, and Dave, I was wondering, were we monitoring the laboratory for inflammatory lab tests? And did you notice a dramatic drop in those after you started the Plaquenil? Because I think we think that the hydroxychloroquine actually probably works more not as an antiviral, but as an anti-inflammatory agent, similar to what we see in autoimmune disease.
Terry, I have his chart open. I'm going to try to do that. He was tested he had a procalcitonin on the 21st of 0.18. Normal for us is less than 0.7. On the 23rd, 2 days later, it was 0.20. And by the 26th, it was down to 0.06. So I don't have a timeline on the hydroxychloroquine administration and resulting response, but it was, he was started on the hydroxychloroquine on the 21st. 2 days later, it was slightly higher. And then after that, it was, again, a little bit, I want to say a little bit lower, but, 3 days later, it was lower down to 0.6. So,
the way that the infectious disease docs are recommending this is to do the hydroxychloroquine for it. They say at least 5 days. And so a lot of, sometimes we'll extend it to 10 or maybe 8, just depending on, you know, the CRP, which we often monitor, that if that's coming down, I mean, one of them was above 100 and they got down to the normal range. We basically stop it once they're showing signs of significant clinical improvement or once they've gotten down into the normal range is how I've seen the length of the Plaquenil play out. So it's case by case, but in general, these 5 days worth of it for the Plaquenil too.
Was there a left shift at all, or did you see a lymphocytic shift throughout his course?
I will try to answer that, Terry, with the information in front of me. His white count on admission was 7,300. On the following day, it was 5,700. And let me see if I can expand that differential. There we go. And the differential, let's see, first day, no, he really didn't have much of any type of, he had a reduced lymphocyte count, 6% neutrophils, and it never went above 6.4% for the rest of his hospitalization with that. So his absolute neutrophil count was 6,200 on admission, and it was somewhere around 4,000, bumped a little bit to 6,000 one day, but stayed in that 4 to 6,400 range through his hospitalization.
And one last question I had, Dave, what was his platelet count? Did that go up dramatically or not?
Platelet count on admission was 126,000 on admission. And at its peak, which was on day 20, on 327, the day prior to extubation, was 251. Now, I'm going to take that back. The day of discharge, it was 274,000. So it doubled from admission, but never was out of the ordinary.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
All right, I'm going to go to the questions. On the question and answer list, Dr. Mundorf asked, did you use proning with your first patient?
No.
All right. And then Dr. Kumar asks, how was echo? Any cardiac involvement?
I'm going to let, since Dr. Fields has the chart open, there was definitely some concern for cardiomyopathy. But I'm not sure what the end conclusion was. We did have cardiology see them.
Okay. About the time of discharge, and they didn't want the echo sonographer to have exposure unless he was doing more poorly. But right before discharge, his EF was 45 to 50%. Some of that was he had his atrial fib rates were still not well controlled initially; they were still running in the 100 to 110 range. And that might have caused a momentary reduction of the EF. It was a little difficult because he's, like I said, he's 6'3", 360. He's a big guy. So I do think that cardiology is going to do some follow-up with that. But he did have a reduced EF, but no other signs of valvular abnormality.
Yep. And I've got to excuse myself at this point.
Quick question for you. Out of all the patients who are inpatients, how many ended up being ventilated and intubated and ventilated?
You know, that's a bit hard for me to answer because we had a policy where the hospitalists take care of them unless they're on more than like 2 liters. And so I know there were, My gut feel is about 50-50. I don't know if you have a better sense of it, Dr. Fields, but
I know we've had three intubate. We have two active intubations now, and
well, I extubated the second one, so
okay.
So we've got there's one rule out that it was intubated, but they're still pending. Okay. But in general,
50-50.
Yeah, I would say.
I will add that there was zinc that was used on this patient also. I know there's some anecdotal stuff about zinc, yep. So that was used through an NG tube, just to add real quickly.
Yep. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Thank you.
Hello? Yes, we can, Dr. Johnson.
I'm sorry, I'm behind trying to figure out how to use this computer, get this to work. So I've been listening for a while. I'm one of the intensivists and pulmonologists in Fargo. And I'm currently working on our COVID unit. We've cohorted all these patients into one unit. So we have an internist taking care of the non-critical patients, but watching them carefully in case they decline. And then, you know, we have currently four intubated patients and then one intubated that's still a COVID rule out. We're getting a second test on. So I don't know. I kind of missed some of it, but wanted to weigh in, on what we're seeing here. What we're seeing is, you know, more this L-type lung injury where there's not truly like an ARDS-type picture. We're seeing, you know, like an altered perfusion, severe hypoxemia that responds really well to low levels of PEEP, actually. We are using the hydroxychloroquine. It's 400 milligrams twice a day for one day, and then we use 200 twice a day for four more days. And then we did extend it to 10 days in one patient who was very, very ill. We've also been using the azithromycin to monitoring QT. We've not had much problem with QT prolongation at this point. We are also checking IL-6 levels and considering that when it comes back, we've given a couple of patients tocilizumab for its anti-inflammatory effects, anti-IL-6 properties. And we just extubated one of those patients today who's been intubated for over 14 days. We do have one patient who's got severe neurologic complications, what looks like Guillain-Barré. From this, he's getting IVIG currently, and the hydroxychloroquine azithromycin. We're trying to get convalescent plasma for him from the Mayo Clinic, but that's not come through yet. We've not been seeing a lot of the cardiomyopathy that's been reported. We're checking echoes on everyone. And the only thing I would say is it's a really sneaky process that we're dealing with. I just extubated a 37-year-old male who I thought was going to do well, passed my breathing trial. He's been sick since the 25th of March, and he has now failed extubation over the last 5 hours, just had to reintubate him. So otherwise, in someone who I thought would do well, he's now back on the ventilator, unfortunately.
Those are great updates. I think that this is a great way to do our shared experience. Unfortunately, Haven had to go to the ER. They have an emergency he's going to have to care for down there. So I'm sorry he had to sign off. But Carrie, I do appreciate your input with things. It's too bad we can't get a little bit of that cross-communication with our specialists, because you guys have such a wealth that you could share back and forth for sure. I think we would all be better for it. That's obvious. So,
thanks, Dr. Johnson. I noticed that either you or Dr. Field may be able to answer this. Dr. Singhal asked average ventilator mode settings.
Have to let Kara handle that one. I'm not. That's not my level of expertise by far.
So we're starting people on 6 mL/kg, so like a low tidal volume strategy on everyone. And then we're, you know, trying to determine how much PEEP they need. There are some, the patients I have on the ventilator are between 8 and 12 of PEEP currently. I have not had anybody that's required high levels of PEEP. Again, I think there's concern in people that have this L-type lung injury, that if you use high levels of PEEP, you actually over-distend and cause lung injury. So you need to kind of tweeze out or tease out who is the L type, doesn't need a lot of PEEP, you know, has like an altered perfusion type of lung injury versus someone who has like a true ARDS picture, because they've both been demonstrated with this illness. So currently they're not hard to oxygenate or ventilate when they're on the ventilator, these L-type patients. But it's just that they seem to have pretty, you know, refractory hypoxemia that requires some positive pressure, yet they don't need a lot of positive pressure, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Dr. Belf asked, have you noticed any cognitive impairments once the patient woke up, like in other viral encephalitis cases?
I know we have, we've been scouting for that. We've noticed some slight cognitive issues with our 37-year-old. He came through with flying colors. There's some worry with one of the older patients that we're going to see a little bit of things. We have talked to our neurologist, and they're starting to see a few more in some other areas with some neurologic lag, such as the Guillain-Barré. It would be different than the Guillain-Barré, but we don't know if there's some other things that are going on with some of their other health issues, at least what our neurology docs have kind of filled in. Kara, have you noticed anything with your area, with your folks?
I haven't been on long enough to be able to answer that. I would say that talking to Chris Pribula, who's the hospitalist that's been on for the last 2 weeks taking care of them, we've had a couple people with confusion. And then we have this gentleman with Guillain-Barré who actually has aseptic meningitis as well along with this. I don't know that people are having, longer lasting neurologic complications or issues other than that. I do know that one prominent thing we're seeing is that there's a period of time where people have significant nausea, vomiting, and can't maintain their hydration. So we're admitting people, not necessarily all the time for hypoxemia, but inability to maintain their nutrition and hydration as an outpatient. We have had several of those that are COVID-19 positive.
We've only had one go home at this time that was intubated, but we are noticing some swallow and some speech issues, little cognitive stuff that our OT people are kind of hinting at. But again, I think we'll have more as we accumulate information with good outpatient follow that we're kind of into.
Dr. Kumar asks, what is L type?
So there's two different types of lung injury that are being seen with coronavirus infection. One is called L-type, the other is called H-type. The L-type is sort of like there's low elastance or high compliance in the lung. So they don't really act like ARDS. They act like they're actually very PEEP responsive, even to like low levels of PEEP. And they tend to have pretty refractory hypoxemia, almost like it's like an altered perfusion state that's going on in the lungs. These are the people that they describe don't even know they're hypoxic, or maybe sitting there watching television and their SATs are in the 60s. These are sort of the patients that kind of describe this L type. It's more so hypoxemia out of proportion to the lung findings, and then very responsive to low levels of PEEP. I mean, 8, 10, maybe 12. And then there's the H type, which is the high elastance or low compliance patient on the ventilator that acts a lot like ARDS, where they have refractory hypoxemia, require high levels of PEEP, and pretty much act like, you would expect an ARDS patient to act. Now, we're seeing a lot of this, what seems to be altered perfusion, hypoxemia out of proportion to imaging, very responsive to even, 8, 10 of PEEP on the ventilator, not hard to oxygenate, just really touchy. As far as you try to come down on the PEEP and they start desatting. They're on 8 to 10 of PEEP, you turn them, they desat. Like the guy today that I took off the ventilator, I thought was ready to come off the ventilator, and then he failed within just a few hours, which is unusual given how well he did on his breathing trial, for example.
Carrie, you said he was 37. Did he have any other health issues that were present prior to this injury or this infection?
Perfectly healthy.
Boy, that's scary.
No health issues at all. And he's been sick for going on close to 2 weeks.
Dr. Johnson, Dr. Green submitted a question, but he says that I've heard from my friends in New York who feel this is less of a pneumonia type picture and the ARDS we see is secondary to damage caused by the ventilator. The pic they describe is more comparable to what we call high altitude sickness. Do either of you have opinions on this or insight?
Yeah, I think you have to be careful with the ventilator. And what they're describing is that you need to be careful with the pressures on the ventilator, not only classically how we think about, you know, using low tidal volume and be careful about the plateau pressures and these sorts of things, but you have to be careful about the driving pressure. What that's the difference between the plateau and the PEEP. And if that's too high, people think that, you know, patients are getting like lung injury from having too much of a difference in these pressures. Now, you know, some people are saying that, you know, again, it's sort of a unique illness. I don't know that I've seen anything quite like this before, but I do believe that there's, you have to be careful with these ventilators because I do think that there are types of lung injury that we're not necessarily used to looking for that may be happening in some of these patients. In particular, I think you have to be careful how much PEEP you use. If you use too much, you're going to cause lung injury. And then there's this L type out there that you have to be careful, again, how much PEEP you're using. I do think that there's this idea, again, that you have to watch the difference between the pressures. And if the difference in the pressures is too high, you should be making adjustments in your ventilator to prevent this other type of injury, which is what I believe you're describing.
All right, any other questions online or raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question? All right, I think we'll move over to our next two presenters then, Dr. Tobias and Dr. Van Eerden. Thank you, Dr. Field and Dr. Malish and Dr. Johnson. To be continued. I'll be in touch with you because I think this was very productive conversation.
Thank you very much, Courtney. Be safe and good luck with everybody, please.
Thank you.
Oh, here, I gotta unmute. Okay. All right, I should have, both of you should be unmuted then.
Okay. Let me just get this open. I don't know why this isn't. Oh, there we go. And sorry, can you see my screen?
Not yet.
Okay. Now?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, you know, I don't have a lot of new information to go over since last week, and I don't know how many OB providers we have on the phone or on the call here, but what I really wanted to do today was just kind of, you know, this is what we talked about last week very briefly. Obviously, each of these individually could be a talk in and of itself, and we only have a short period of time, but I wanted to make sure that everybody who, especially everybody really, but people especially who are taking care of pregnant patients, have all the right resources and then they know what resources to go to, because these things are coming out quickly and they're changing rapidly. And we're trying to keep up to date with all of that, but it can be sometimes difficult. So this slide by itself kind of presents what's out there. Initially, there were an expert opinion from MFM about just guidance in the outpatient clinics for ultrasounds, antepartum testing, prenatal care as to how to take care of patients. That has not really been updated very much as far as I'm aware. And then there was an expert opinion about labor and delivery management. And again, this is really not a this is not a national guideline. This is really just an expert opinion. And then the guidelines that are out that are indeed national guidelines come from SMFM and the Society of Obstetric Anesthesia and Perinatology. And these are guidelines for labor and delivery. And they're pretty clearly laid out as to what to do. And then there's some guidelines for from ISUOG and AIUM, which is basically ultrasound specific. So for if you're doing ultrasounds in your units or fetal ultrasounds, first trimester, second trimester anatomy scans, things like that, especially talking about protection for your sonographers. And then some coding guidelines just came out the other day as well. And I'm not really gonna talk about any of that. And then there were a couple of pieces of literature that came out in the past week or so that I'll just kind of mention. And then I know that the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine is going to be updating their guidelines soon. ACOG really hasn't made any major budges lately, nor really has the CDC, but I have a couple of comments about that. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly because anybody who is taking care of pregnant people probably have seen most of this stuff, but I just wanted to make sure you have. When all of this began, this is the first thing that really came out, which is basically an algorithm for how to evaluate a patient and what to do. And I think we've all kind of worked with our hospital systems and come up with the right thing in terms of symptoms and who to test and who not to test. They do, you know, elevate pregnancy specifically. At one point they said that just symptoms alone were enough to test when we were looking at travel history and exposure history, but I think those things are kind of going away now anyway. But I think we've all worked out these guidelines. So the first main guideline that came out was the clinic guideline. Like I said, this was looking at how to deal with visits, scheduling your ultrasounds, antepartum testing, non-stress tests, biophysical profiles, visitor policy and training and involvement of trainees. And again, that's happening with all the different specialties in our hospitals too. And so these are just some pictures of like what their recommendations are. I'm not gonna go into them at all in detail, and they're in the guidelines. And if you don't have them and you want them, I can certainly make sure you get to them. The other expert opinion that came out was the one on labor and delivery guidelines. And they go through, again, screening and testing and preparing your labor and delivery unit. They look at triage, who to test, who not to test, talking about isolation, sanitation procedures, and then what to do for a screen positive patient. They do give some guidelines on PPE, and I know that's a hot topic and we're all talking about it and pushing for it in our own areas, and things need to be prioritized. They talk about labor and delivery workflow, intrapartum care, postpartum care, and then there's also some talk about taking care of a COVID positive patient on the labor and delivery, and then some things that are unique to labor and delivery and antepartum, like the use of steroids for lung maturity, magnesium sulfate, indomethacin. We did bring that up last week a little bit. Also that some of the lab changes that can occur in COVID are very similar to preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome, which obviously is unique to pregnancy. And then they make some recommendations and guidelines for intrapartum care and postpartum care. They do have there's a section specifically talking about critically ill patients. Obviously, these are going to be primarily managed by our critical care pulmonary people, and then we would be involved because certainly there are some physiologic changes in pregnancy that may impact, you know, certain things in terms of how we take care of those patients. And I'm going to just kind of zip through this because this came out sort of early during all this coronavirus issue about what to do on your labor floor. And then obviously the big issue that's come up was the appropriate use of N95 masks for the second stage of labor. Originally the CDC said that pushing, which is the second stage of labor, was not an aerosolizing procedure. And then American College of OBGYN, SMFM apparently had a phone call with the CDC, who verbally said that in fact it was, and they do agree with recommending using that, particularly in COVID positive or PUI patients. And I think I don't know if anybody else has been having any problem, but we really haven't been having any problem at Sanford and Fargo and the other enterprise Sanford sites for labor and delivery with having them agree to allowing us to use the appropriate PPE during that second stage of labor. I did notice today that ACOG kind of made an update here about PPE shortage. We all know that's a problem. So I think I have this somewhere else. The Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine and the Society of Obstetrics and Anesthesia in Perinatology do have a formal guideline which goes through labor and delivery, and it's kind of similar to the guideline that was just the expert opinion, and it has all of those things that we just talked about. So, some of the information that has come out, like in terms of data, especially from New York, the first thing that came out of there, and I know they're really busy, but obviously it was great that they're able to publish their work. They described their first seven cases of COVID in pregnancy, and they noted that two out of the seven were actually asymptomatic on admission, and we all know that that's a big problem, is that these asymptomatic patients can be positive. And that's why we're pushing with our institutions for universal PPE and universal testing, but you know, we're still kind of working on that and on the labor floor. Because of these asymptomatic patients, it's exposing healthcare workers to transmission risk, utilizing PPE potentially, and risk of ill providers being out. There were also two cases reported of cardiomyopathy in pregnancy. And as we talked about earlier in this talk, it sounded like in Fargo, all the non-pregnant patients are getting echoes, and we would definitely want to advocate for getting an echo in our pregnant patients that were to develop this, particularly given the fact that pregnant women without coronavirus can get a peripartum cardiomyopathy. And so it would be important to make sure that we are in fact doing that. And then probably the biggest study that came out in the past week was the first 43 cases at Columbia in New York in pregnancy. And the first point here is that we're finding, or at least they're finding, that the rates of mild, severe, and critical illness are pretty much matching those in the non-pregnant cohorts, which is definitely better than like with SARS and MERS and H1N1. So that's the first thing that's kind of coming out. Second thing is the same as what we saw before, is that 30% of the patients that presented were asymptomatic. So they came in, they were testing them because they were doing a universal testing, and they found that 32% of patients were indeed positive for coronavirus. And then the other thing that's coming out of this first piece of information is no neonatal transmission. So the original reports were reassuring, and then there were some reports in JAMA stating that the babies were testing positive for the PCR as well as the IgM. And the first 18 babies in this particular group were actually testing negative. So that's definitely reassuring. So Anna, I don't know if you want to make any comments yet.
Just keep going.
So the results, the implications of this study that's come out is that universal testing potentially has value, because if we know what's going on, we can initiate appropriate infection control. So I don't think that our prevalence is as high as New York, and therefore our asymptomatic positive rate is probably a lot lower than 30%, but who knows, and who knows when that's going to change. So knowing who's positive on the labor floor when they come in for elective inductions, elective cesareans, unscheduled labor would definitely be useful and could help prevent exposure of our healthcare workers, as we all are arguing for. And then it also can provide useful information for the well baby nursery, because, you know, pregnant moms imply that they're going to have baby, right? So then knowing that the mom is positive or negative would be good information for the pediatric and neonatology providers. The other thing that kind of came out of this is, you know, fever, shortness of breath, cough, those are the symptoms that we're looking for. But, you know, pregnant women during labor and delivery oftentimes can get a fever, and oftentimes it's attributed to chorioamnionitis or interamniotic infection. But we now need to add COVID-19 to the differential diagnosis in that situation, as well as for those patients who postpartum have a fever or develop shortness of breath postpartum or intrapartum. I just wanted to point out that Bergella, he's one of the MFMs at Jefferson, and he's one of the guys that's been involved with a lot of the publications, and he did do a nice review on this and up to date. So if you're not aware of that, it could be worth looking at that to keep up to date on that. And then I also wanted to point out that there is a study going on out of the University of California in San Francisco. I think I mentioned it last week, but they will take all PUIs and COVID positives. So they want to know about everybody. So just to, you know, in the interest of research, to just, you can send your patients there, they can call and self apply to the study. The other thing for really anybody that's interested, but specifically the OB providers, and you may already be part of it, and I've tried to reach out to everybody, is I did create a Facebook group called Sanford OB COVID and Pregnancy, and I'm just trying to publish on there as posts like the latest studies that are coming out and a lot of the webinars that are going on. So the perinatal quality collaboratives around the country are putting on webinars, particularly like Massachusetts, and the national one has put on some webinars. Ohio is doing some. And then Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine has a lot of good webinars going on. So I'm trying to put all that stuff on there so you have all those resources. So that's kind of that. I don't know if you want to add anything or if people have questions.
No, thanks. That was good. And the other thing we had talked about on that Facebook group is making a file in there for keeping kind of the more up-to-date official documents so you have an easy place to access it. So, because right now there's a lot of stuff all over with every society that we subscribe to. So just one place to look for stuff. And then I also wanted to suggest that for those of you that maybe need a refresher on critical care and pregnancy, SMFM had put out a critical care webinar, I think it was last week or the week before, that is excellent. It's kind of a nice refresher. And if anyone has questions, of course, feel free to get a hold of either of us. We'd be happy to help talk through some stuff. So,
yeah, and they've made that free. So I think, and I think it's only through May. I'm sure they'll extend it, who knows. But it's usually like $500.
Does anyone have any questions? I don't see any hands raised or anything typed in the question and answer. Please feel free to ask these guys some questions. Okay, Dr. Kumar.
So Sanford Bismarck and Sanford Sioux Falls are like following different policies about the babies, like who are going to be born and with separation from the mother or caring for the baby in the same room. So what is the recommendation of the perinatologist as far as the care of the baby is concerned for best practices? And there is conflicting recommendations from different societies in the pediatric groups. Thank you. And I'm a pediatric hospitalist taking care of normal newborns in Sanford Bismarck.
I think that, at least in Fargo, I think the, you know, the pediatric hospitalists and the neonatologists have been the ones kind of driving that, but the CDC originally said separate, if it's a COVID positive mom, to separate her for 14 days. And then they changed it to, after having a informed consent discussion, they can either stay in the room, or if the patient doesn't want that, the baby can in fact be separated. But they also say that the mom can, you know, breastfeed, but those guys have been the ones that have been really driving that. I don't know, Anna, if you have anything to say about that.
No, and you're right. Every organization has their own opinion. I guess my opinion would be, if mom is too sick to care for the baby probably shouldn't be in the room. You know, that's the first thing. And then second thing, because we don't really know the risk to the baby with this. I know most of what has come out has been reassuring, but there have been a few cases the last couple of weeks of babies getting sick, and, you know, maybe one or two that have potentially died from this. And so I don't know what the right answer is.
So I and Dr. Tobias had struggled with a situation in which if the mother would have come back COVID positive, then she would have gone ahead and do the delivery. So if suppose there is a patient who is like about to deliver and is like term and is not in labor, is it standard of care now that you would go ahead and deliver that mom?
So right now there's, I don't think it's an official recommendation, but there's an opinion suggestion that if they're term, they should probably be delivered. So 39 weeks and above, they should probably be delivered. Between 37 to 39, I think it's going to be a case by case discussion. Below 37, if mom is not critically ill, meaning she can be managed outpatient, would be better to not deliver. But if they're critically ill beyond 34 weeks, they should probably be delivered.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's going to be a gray zone between 34 to 39, just depending on circumstances and how sick mom is. So.
All right, we have a question from Dr. Johnson asking, have you had any pregnant patients with COVID-19?
So in answer to the first question, we do have a 14-week pregnant patient who tested positive and she has not even had her first prenatal care visit yet. I was just informed about this. I think she's at home doing okay, and then we'll ultimately see her at 20 weeks to look at the baby's anatomy, and then we'll do a follow-up growth scan. But certainly if we have any second or third trimester or babies, moms that are pregnant past 23 to 24 weeks that are ill, especially if they're in the hospital, I absolutely anticipate that Dr. Johnson will be involved with those patients. But that's the only patient that I'm aware of. And I don't know if there's any in Bismarck, and I haven't heard about falls.
Yep, there's one in Bismarck who's also first trimester. She's also well enough to be home. So, but same thing, you know, we'll see her a few weeks down the road once she's recovered. And so.
And then the second question is, I know that, being in the ICU and not having a lot of pregnancy exposures, we absolutely are totally comfortable with both Plaquenil and Zithromycin. Plaquenil is actually something we use in pregnancy to prevent fetal heart block in patients that are lupus with positive SSA antibodies. And so if I have a pregnant patient who has positive SSA antibodies and a high titer, I'm actually going to start her on Plaquenil, even if she's not on it because of her lupus, to prevent that, number one. And number two, azithromycin in the doses that you're talking about are totally fine. We give Z-packs out to patients. We use azithromycin in the hospital with patients with ruptured membranes to prevent or to prolong the latency of the ruptured membranes if it occurs prematurely. So we're totally fine with those medications.
Dr. Gaba has their hand up.
Yeah, so a full-term pregnant lady in labor with COVID positive came to me. I'm just giving you a scenario. If she's coming to me for delivery, either a normal delivery or it will be C-section, is there any contraindication of epidural or spinal in these cases?
No. Not that's been recommended at this point.
Yeah, and the guidelines do say that you can have an epidural or a spinal, and you can have a vaginal delivery at this point.
Yep.
All right, Dr. Kumar, you had another question?
No, I think that was answered already. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? Well, I think that's about it. Thank you, Dr. Van Eerden and Dr. Tobias. Very, very good presentation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Well, I guess we'll wrap that up for another week of the Wednesday weekly webinar. Thank you everyone for attending and listening and asking questions. And if you have any ideas about future speakers, please let me know. Thank you.
Hey, can I say one word?
Sure.
Tomorrow, the AMA is hosting that town hall meeting, and I think it's at 1 o'clock. And I just want to encourage everybody who has the opportunity to participate in that to participate. I think it will be good for our souls and also extend these kind of conversations to a national level, and you can probably bring some stuff home to share with us next week. So I would really encourage you to do that. And then for those of you who are interested in the convalescent plasma information, I just got another email from Vitalant, and so I will be passing that along. So make sure that you keep current, because it looks like there's going to be plasma available either via Mayo or the Red Cross or Vitalant soon. And then the last thing I wanted to follow up, is anybody having any additional concerns about elective procedures, or have everybody's institutions followed the recommendations?
I haven't heard any, Joan.
Okay, good. So that's awesome. All right, well, if you guys need anything, from the Department of Health, don't hesitate to let me know, or if you have any concerns, I'm happy to visit with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Connell. All right, and if you need that link to the AMA webinar, I can send that to you. It's open to all members, not just AMA members. And so if you're interested, please let me know. Thank you, everyone. See you next week.
Thanks for everything, Courtney.
Bye. Bye-bye. Done. Kumar, he loves these videos. I muted him, and I think he wanted to talk somewhere. And...
but he had some questions.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. He's not dumb. That's for sure. I stopped it, I thought.